I'm on page 325 of An Outline of Esoteric Science, Chapter 5. This is the third part of Chapter 5 that I'm reading, and it begins on paragraph 34. To put it precisely, the goal of meditating on the symbolic mental images and feelings characterized above is to develop higher organs of perception within the human astral body. Initially, these organs are created out of the substance of the astral body. They inform us about a new world where we get to know ourselves as new eyes. These new perceptual organs are already different from those of the physical world of the senses in that they are active organs. Eyes and ears passively allow light and sound to work on them, but our perceptual organs of spirit and soul can be said to be constantly active during perception and grasp objects and facts in full consciousness, so to speak. As a result, we experience soul-spiritual cognition as a process of uniting with the facts in question and, quote, dwelling in them, unquote. Metaphorically speaking, these developing individual organs of soul and spirit can be called, quote-unquote, lotus flowers, because this corresponds to the imaginative picture supersensible consciousness has to make of them. Parenthesis, of course, we must realize that this term has nothing more to do with the actual thing in question than the term chamber does when we speak of the chambers of the heart, parenthesis. Through very specific types of meditation, we work on the astral body in such a way that one or the other soul-spiritual organ or lotus flower takes shape. After everything that has been described in this book, it should be superfluous to mention that we must not imagine such an organ as something whose reality is reflected by our sensory mental image of it. These organs are supersensible and consist of soul activity that is shaped in a particular way. They exist only inasmuch and as long as this soul activity is being exercised. There is nothing sense perceptible about these organs, just as no vapor is present around a human being who is thinking. We fall into misunderstandings if we insist on imagining the supersensible as sense perceptible in any way. Although this remark is quite superfluous, it is inserted here because we repeatedly encounter people who are convinced of the existence of the supersensible, but try to imagine it only as something sense-perceptible. We also repeatedly encounter opponents of supersensible cognition, who believe that spiritual researchers are speaking of lotus flowers as if they were talking about delicate sense-perceptible formations. Any genuine meditation that is done with regard to imaginative cognition has an effect on one or the other of these organs. Parenthesis, details on methods of meditation and exercises that influence specific organs may be found in my book, How to Know Higher Worlds, parenthesis. In any genuine training, the student's individual exercises are set up and arranged in a sequence so that the organs can develop accordingly, either in conjunction with one another or one after the other. This training requires a great deal of patience and persistence on the student's part. The usual amount of patience people acquire as a result of their situation in life is not sufficient, because it often takes a long, long time before these organs have developed enough to be used for perception in the higher world. When this finally happens, it can be called enlightenment, in contrast to the period of preparation or purification that consists of exercises to develop the organs. Parenthesis, the word purification is used here because these exercises purify a certain part of the student's inner life, eliminating everything that comes exclusively from the world of sensory observation. Parenthesis. It's certainly possible for people who have not yet experienced actual enlightenment to receive repeated flashes of light from a higher world. Even such flashes allow them to bear witness to spiritual worlds and should be accepted with gratitude. But students should not waver if these flashes do not appear during the preparation period, which may seem unduly long. People who are still capable of becoming impatient because they don't see anything yet have not yet acquired the right relationship to the higher world, a relationship understood only by those who are capable of seeing the training exercises as almost an end in themselves. In actual fact, these exercises are working on our soul's spiritual nature, that is, on the astral body. Even if we cannot see, we can feel that we are doing soul's spiritual work. The only possible reason for not being able to feel this is having a preconceived idea of what we are actually trying to see. In that case, we will think nothing of something that is actually immensely significant. However, we must be subtly attentive to all of our experiences while practicing, because they are so very different from all of our experiences in the world of the senses. We will then notice that we are not simply making impressions on the astral body as if it were some indifferent substance. There is a whole world in there that is different from the life our senses tell us about. Higher beings work on the astral body in the same way the outer physical world of the senses works on the physical body. We quote-unquote bump into the higher life in our own astral body if we do not close ourselves off to it. But if we repeatedly say to ourselves, quote, I don't perceive anything, unquote, it's usually because we have preconceived ideas of how this perception is supposed to look. Because we are not seeing what we have convinced ourselves we ought to see, we say that we don't see anything. However, once we have the right attitude about doing these training exercises, we will increasingly find something in them that we can love for its own sake. We will realize that the very act of practicing places us in the midst of a world of spirit and soul, and we will wait patiently and humbly for what may follow. This attitude can best become conscious in us in these words: I will do all the exercises that are suitable for me, knowing that at the right time as much will come to me as is important for me to have. I do not demand this impatiently, but I am constantly preparing to receive it. It is not legitimate to object that students of the Spirit have to grope around in the dark indefinitely because success alone can show them that they are on the right path. It's not true that this is the only way to know that we are doing the right exercises. If we take the right approach to our exercises, the satisfaction we gain will make it clear that we are doing the right thing. We do not have to wait for success to have this certainty. Appropriate practice in the field of spiritual training goes hand in hand with a satisfaction that is more than just satisfaction. It is also knowledge, the knowledge of being able to see that what we are doing is leading us in the right direction. We can have this knowledge at any time if we pay attention to the subtleties of what we are experiencing. If we do not, this experience escapes us, and we pass it by like hikers, lost in thought, who fail to see the trees on either side of the trail, although they would be able to see them if they simply paid attention to them. Success invariably does come if we continue to practice. And it is not at all desirable to force results to appear more quickly. If we did, the result might be only a small part of what actually should have appeared. With regard to spiritual development, partial success is often the reason for a great delay in achieving complete success. Moving among the forms of spiritual life that constitute partial success dulls us to the influences of forces that can lead to higher levels of development. We only appear to have gained something by having, quote-unquote, seen into the spiritual world, because seeing it in this way gives us deceptive images instead of truth. As the soul's spiritual organs, or lotus flowers, take shape, they appear to supersensible consciousness to be located close to certain organs in the physical body of the person undergoing training. Of these soul organs, we may mention the following: the so-called two-petaled lotus flower that we feel as if between the eyebrows, the 16-petaled lotus flower in the area of the larynx, the 12-petaled lotus flower in the area of the heart, and a fourth that is located near the solar plexus. Other such organs appear in the vicinity of other parts of the physical body. Parenthesis: the names two-petaled or 16-petaled can be used because the organs in question can be compared to flowers with a corresponding number of petals. Parenthesis. We become conscious of the lotus flowers through the astral body. As soon as we have developed one or the other of these organs, we are also aware that we have it. We feel that we are able to make use of it, and that in doing so we are actually entering a higher world. In many respects, our impressions of this world are still similar to impressions of the physical world of the senses. People with imaginative cognition will be able to speak of this new higher world in terms of sensations of warmth or cold, perceptions of sounds and words, and impressions of light or color, because that is how they experience it. However, they are aware that these perceptions express something different in the imaginative world than they do in the world of sense-perceptible reality. They realize that the senses underlying them are soul-spiritual rather than physical-material ones. If they receive something like an impression of warmth, they do not attribute it to a piece of hot iron, for example, but think of it as emanating from a soul process similar to the ones they had, until now, been familiar with only in their own soul life. They know that soul-spiritual things and processes stand behind these imaginative perceptions, just as material, physical beings and realities stand behind physical perceptions. Alongside the similarity between the imaginative and physical worlds, however, there is also a significant difference. One thing that is present in the physical world appears quite differently in the imaginative world. In the physical world, we can observe things constantly coming into existence and disappearing again. There is a constant alternation between birth and death. In the imaginative world, this phenomenon is replaced by the constant transformation of one thing into another. For example, in the physical world, we see a plant die and decompose. In the imaginative world, another configuration that is physically imperceptible comes about as the plant withers away. The decaying plant is gradually transformed into this other configuration. Once the plant has completely disappeared, this figure has developed fully and taken its place. Birth and death are ideas that lose their significance in the imaginative world. They are replaced by the concept of one thing being transformed into another. Because of this, certain truths about our human makeup become accessible to imaginative cognition. These truths are the ones presented in Chapter 2 of this book. As far as physical sensory perception is concerned, only the processes of the physical body are perceptible. These are played out in the domain of birth and death. The other members of our human makeup, the life body, the sentient body, and the eye, are subject to the laws of transformation and are perceptible to imaginative cognition. Anyone who has advanced to this stage perceives how something that goes on living after death in another state of existence releases itself, so to speak, from the physical body at death. However, inner development does not stop at the level of the imaginative world. If we chose to stop here, we would perceive beings who are undergoing processes of transformation, but we would not be able to interpret these processes, nor would we be able to orient ourselves in this newly won world. The imaginative world is a restless region, full of movement and transformation. There are no resting places in it. We reach such resting places only by developing beyond the level of imaginative cognition to what can be called cognition through inspiration. It is not necessary for those seeking knowledge about the supersensible world to acquire the faculty of imaginative cognition to its fullest extent before moving on to inspiration. There, exercises may be arranged so that what leads to imagination develops parallel to what leads to inspiration. After the appropriate amount of time, these students will enter a higher world, where, in addition to being able to perceive, they will also be able to orient themselves and interpret what they see. Typically, however, they first perceive some of the phenomena of the imaginative world, and only later feel that they are gaining the ability to orient themselves. Compared to the world of mere imagination, however, the world of inspiration is something totally new. Through imagination, we perceive the transformation of one process into another. But through inspiration, we become familiar with the inner qualities of the beings who are undergoing transformation. Through imagination, we recognize the soul expression of these beings, but through inspiration we penetrate their inner spiritual nature. Above all, we recognize a multitude of spiritual beings and the relationships between them. In the physical world of the senses, we are also dealing with a multitude of different beings, but the multitude in the world of inspiration is different in character. There, each being's very specific relationships to others are determined by its inner makeup, rather than by external influences, as is the case in the physical world. When we perceive a being in the world of inspiration, we do not perceive any outer effect it might have on another, that is, any effect comparable to how physical beings affect each other. Instead, the relationship between beings comes about through how they are each inwardly constituted. In the physical world, this relationship can be compared to the relationship between individual sounds or letters in a word. Let's take the word human. It is brought about by the combined sounding of the speech sounds, H-U-M-A-N. Although there is no impetus or other external influence connecting the H to the U, the two sounds work together within the totality because of how they are inwardly constituted. For this reason, observing the world of inspiration can only be compared to reading, and beings in this world are like letters of the alphabet in how they affect observers. We must become familiar with these letters and decipher their interrelationships like supersensible writing. This is why spiritual science also calls cognition through inspiration, quote, reading the hidden script, unquote. How this hidden script is read and how what has been read can be communicated will now be made clear using previous chapters of this book as examples. The first thing described was how the makeup of the human being consists of different components. Next, it was shown how the cosmic body on which human beings evolve has passed through various conditions during the Saturn, Sun, Moon, and Earth phases of evolution. The perceptions that allow us to recognize the members of our human makeup, on the one hand, and the Earth's successive stages and earlier metamorphoses on the other, are perceptible to imaginative cognition. However, it is also necessary to recognize the connections that exist between the Saturn state and the physical human body, the Sun state and the ether body, and so on. It must be possible to demonstrate that the seminal nucleus of the physical human body came about already during the Saturn state, and that it then continued to evolve during the Sun, Moon, and Earth states until it reached its present form. For example, it was necessary to show what changes took place in the human being as a result of the separation of the Sun from the Earth, and that something similar happened in relation to the Moon. It was also necessary to describe the interactions that were needed for the transformations in humanity that occurred during the Atlantean Age and the successive periods of the Indian, Persian, and Egyptian cultures, and so on. Depicting these connections does not result from imaginative perception, but from cognition through inspiration, from reading the hidden script in which imaginative perceptions are like letters or sounds. This sort of reading, however, is needed for other things, in addition to explaining what has been described above. We would not be able to understand the whole course of a human life if we were able to look at it only through imaginative cognition. If we were not able to orient ourselves within our imaginative perceptions, we would perceive how the soul's spiritual members are released from what remains behind in the physical world at death, but we would not understand the connections between what happens after a person's death and the states that precede and follow. Without cognition through inspiration, the imaginative world would remain like writing that we stare at without being able to read. When we advance from imagination to inspiration as students of the Spirit, it becomes evident very quickly how wrong it would be to renounce understanding the great phenomena of the cosmos and to attempt to restrict ourselves only to facts that touch upon immediate human interests, so to speak. Those who are not initiated into these things might well say, quote, "It seems to me that the only important thing is to find out what the fate of the human soul is after death. If someone tells me about that, that's enough. Why does spiritual science tell me about distant things like the Saturn and Sun states and the separation of the Sun and the Moon from the Earth?" Unquote. However, if we have been introduced to these things in the right way, we realize that we can never really know what we want to know if we do not also know about these other things that seem so unnecessary. Any description of the human condition after death will remain completely incomprehensible and worthless if we cannot link it to concepts derived from those distant things. Even the simplest supersensible observation makes it necessary to know about such things. For example, when a plant passes from the flowering stage to the fruiting stage, supersensible observers see a transformation taking place in an astral entity that covers and surrounds the flowering plant like a cloud coming from above. If fertilization did not take place, this astral entity would metamorphose into a form quite different from the one it assumes as a result of fertilization. We can understand this whole process as supersensible observation perceives it if we have learned to understand its nature from the great cosmic process undergone by the earth and all its inhabitants at the time when the sun separated from the earth. Before fertilization, the plant's situation is like that of the whole earth prior to the sun's detachment. After fertilization, the plant's flower resembles the earth when the moon forces were still active in it after the sun had detached itself. If we have personally acquired the ideas that can be gained from studying the sun's detachment, we will then objectively perceive the meaning of the process of fertilization in the plant. We will say that the plant is in a sun state before fertilization and in a moon state afterward. Even the very smallest processes in the world can only be understood if we see them as copies of great cosmic processes. Otherwise, their nature remains just as incomprehensible as Raphael's Madonna would be to someone who saw only a little speck of blue because the rest of the picture was covered up. Everything that is now happening in the human being is a copy of all the great cosmic processes that have to do with our existence. If we want to understand what supersensible consciousness observes about phenomena taking place between birth and death, and those taking place between death and a new birth, we will be able to do so if we have acquired the ability to decipher imaginative observations by means of concepts acquired from the study of macrocosmic processes. This study provides us with a key for understanding human life. This is why, in the sense of spiritual science, we are also observing the human being when we observe the Saturn, Sun, and Moon states. Through inspiration, we acquire the ability to recognize the relationships between beings in the higher world. The next higher stage of cognition makes it possible to recognize the actual inner nature of these beings. This level of cognition can be called intuitive cognition. The word intuition is misused in everyday life to mean an indefinite, uncertain insight into something, although it may coincide at times with the truth. We cannot prove that this sudden insight is justifiable. What is meant here, of course, has nothing to do with an intuition, in quotes, of that sort. Here the term intuition is used to designate a cognitive process of the highest degree of light-filled clarity. If we have it, we are fully conscious of its justification. To have knowledge of a sense-perceptible being means to stand outside it and assess it according to external impressions. To have knowledge of a spiritual being through intuition means having become completely at one with it, having united with its inner nature. Students of the Spirit rise to this level of knowledge step by step. Imagination brings us to the point where we no longer feel that perceptions are external qualities of beings. Instead, we recognize in them the emanations of something that is soul spiritual in character. Inspiration leads us still further into the inner nature of beings and teaches us to understand what these beings are for each other. In intuition, we penetrate into the beings themselves. Here, too, we can use the accounts in this book to demonstrate the significance of intuition. The preceding chapter not only told how development proceeded through the Saturn, Sun, and Moon phases of evolution and so on, it also informed us that beings were involved in this development in a great variety of ways. The thrones or spirits of will, the spirits of wisdom, the spirits of movement, and others were all introduced. In the earth phase of evolution, the luciferic and Ahrimanic spirits were mentioned. The structure of the cosmos was traced back to the beings involved in it. We can learn about these things through intuitive cognition, something we already feel if we want to understand even the course of a human life. In the time after death, what has freed itself from the physical bodily aspect of the human being passes through various states. Imaginative cognition would still be more or less able to describe the states immediately following death. However, what happens when a human being advances further into the period between death and a new birth would remain totally incomprehensible to imagination if inspiration were not added to it. Only inspiration is able to discover what can be said about human life after purification in the land of spirits. However, inspiration is no longer adequate for the next stage. It loses the thread of understanding at this point, so to speak. There is a period in human development between death and a new birth when the human being is accessible only to intuition. However, this part of the human being is always within us, and if we want to understand it in its true inner nature, we must also use intuition to seek it out in the time between birth and death. If we attempted to understand the human being exclusively by means of imagination and inspiration, the processes that belong to this innermost being and play from one incarnation into the next would elude us. Therefore, only intuitive cognition makes it possible for us to objectively investigate repeated earthly lives and karma. All the truths that can be communicated about these processes must result from research that makes use of intuitive cognition. Knowledge of the inner being within us can also come only from intuition. Through intuition, we perceive the aspect of ourselves that progresses from one earthly life to another. Exercises for the soul and spirit are the only way we can achieve the knowledge that comes from inspiration and intuition. These exercises are similar to the contemplations or meditations described for acquiring imagination. However, while these exercises that lead to imagination are linked to impressions of the physical world of the senses, this link must increasingly disappear in exercises that lead to inspiration. To clarify what has to happen, let's think again about the symbol of the Rose Cross. By immersing ourselves in it, we have an image before us whose components are taken from impressions of the sensory world, the black color of the cross, the roses, and so on. However, the way these components are combined into the Rose Cross is not derived from the physical world of the senses. If we attempt to eliminate the black cross and red roses from our consciousness as images of sensory realities, and retain in our souls only the spiritual activity that combined them, then we have a means of meditation that will gradually lead to inspiration. Within our souls we should ask, what have I done inwardly in order to combine the cross and roses into this symbol? I want to hold fast to what I have done, to the personal soul process I have undergone, but to allow the image itself to disappear from my consciousness. I will feel everything within me that my soul did in order to bring the image about, but I will not picture the image itself. From this point onward, I will dwell quite inwardly in the activity of mine that created the image. Instead of meditating on an image, I will become absorbed in my own image-creating soul activity. Such absorption, if carried out repeatedly with regard to many symbols, will lead to cognition through inspiration. Here is another example. We meditate on the mental image of a plant that first grows and then decays. We allow an image to come about in our souls of a gradually developing plant as it emerges from the seed, as one leaf after another unfolds, as flowers and fruit develop. Then we picture how the plant begins to wilt. We follow this process to the point of complete dissolution. As we meditate on this image, we gradually arrive at a feeling of becoming and decaying, for which the plant is only an image. When we persevere at this exercise, this feeling develops into an imagination of the process of transformation that underlies physical becoming and decay. However, if we want to achieve the corresponding inspiration, we must do the exercise differently. We must reflect on the actual soul activity that derived the idea of becoming and decay from the image of the plant. We must allow the plant to disappear completely from our consciousness and meditate only on our own inner activity. Only exercises of this sort make it possible to rise to the level of inspiration. Initially, it will not be easy to get a thorough grasp of how to approach such an exercise, because if we are in the habit of allowing our inner life to be determined by outer impressions, we immediately become uncertain and start to vacillate when we have to develop another soul life that has cast off all its connections to these outer impressions. To an even greater degree than in acquiring imaginations, it must be clear to us that we should only undertake exercises that lead to inspiration if we are willing to accompany them with all the precautionary measures that will safeguard and solidify our power of judgment, our feeling life, and our character. Taking these precautions has two results. First, our personalities will not become unbalanced during supersensible perception. Second, we will acquire the ability to really carry out what these exercises demand of us. We will find these exercises difficult only as long as we have not acquired a certain very specific soul makeup, very specific feelings and sensations. If we patiently and persistently cultivate inner faculties in our souls that favor the growth of supersensible cognition, we will soon acquire not only an understanding of these exercises, but also the ability to actually do them. We will gain much by acquiring a habit of often withdrawing into ourselves in a way that is less concerned with brooding about ourselves than with quietly organizing and digesting our experiences in life. We will find that our ideas and feelings are enriched by bringing one experience into relationship with another. We will become aware to what a great extent we experience new things, not only by having new impressions and encounters, but also by allowing the old ones to work in us. If we begin to allow the experiences and even the opinions we have acquired to interact as if we ourselves, with all our sympathies and antipathies and personal interests and feelings, were not even present, we will prepare the ground well for the forces of supersensible cognition. We will truly develop what we can call a rich inner life. However, the most important thing in this regard is the stability and balance of our soul qualities. In devoting ourselves to a certain soul activity, we tend to fall into one-sidedness all too easily. As a result, if we once become aware of the advantages of inner reflection and dwelling in our own world of ideas, we may develop such an inclination toward this that we increasingly shut ourselves off from the impressions of the outer world. This, however, makes our inner life dry and desolate. We will go the farthest if, alongside the ability to retreat into ourselves, we preserve our open receptivity to all impressions of the outer world. This does not apply only to life's so-called important impressions. Any individual in any situation, even in the most miserable surroundings, can experience enough simply by remaining open and receptive. We do not need to go looking for experiences. They are everywhere. It is also especially important how we transform these experiences in our souls. For example, we might make the discovery that someone we or others greatly admire has a certain character trait we would have to consider a shortcoming. This experience can lead our thinking in one of two directions. We could simply say, "Now that I've realized this, I can no longer respect this person the way I used to." Or we could ask ourselves, "How is it possible for this respected person to be afflicted with this particular fault? What must I do to imagine this fault not only as a shortcoming, but as something caused by this person's life, or perhaps even by his or her great qualities?" If we were to ask ourselves these questions, we might come to the conclusion that our respect is in no way diminished by having observed this shortcoming. Every time we come to such a conclusion, we learn something and increase our understanding of life. Now, it would certainly be a bad thing if the merits of this way of looking at life were to mislead us into excusing everything possible in people or things that have our sympathy, or if we were to acquire a habit of disregarding everything that deserves criticism on the grounds that doing so is advantageous for our inner development. This is not the case when the impulse not only to censure but also to understand the faults comes from our own motivations. However, it is advantageous if the instance at hand elicits this attitude, regardless of whether we who judge stand to gain or lose by it. It is absolutely correct that we cannot learn by condemning a fault, but only by understanding it. However, if we want to exclude disapproval entirely for the sake of understanding, we will not get far either. Once again, the important thing is stability and balance in our soul forces, not one-sidedness in one direction or another. This is particularly true of one soul quality that is exceptionally significant for individual development, namely the feeling we call reverence or devotion. This feeling, whether we develop it in ourselves or already possess it as a fortunate gift of nature, forms an excellent basis for supersensible powers of cognition. Being able to look up to certain people in our childhood and youth with devoted admiration, in the same way that we would look up to high ideals, means that supersensible cognition will find fertile ground in our souls where it can thrive. Later on in life, when our judgment has matured, if we look up at the starry heavens and sense the revelation of higher powers with complete devotion and admiration, we are preparing ourselves for knowledge of supersensible worlds. And this is also true when we are able to appreciate the forces that prevail in human life. It is of no little significance if, as adults, we are still able to have the highest degree of reverence for other people whose worth we surmise or believe to recognize. Only when such reverence is present can a view into the higher worlds open up. If we are not capable of reverence, we will never advance very far in our knowledge. If we do not want to acknowledge the worth of anything in the world, the essence of things will remain closed to us. In contrast, however, if our feelings of reverence and devotion tempt us to totally kill off our healthy self-awareness and self-confidence, we sin against the law of soul stability and balance. Students of the Spirit will work on themselves continually to make themselves ever more mature. But when they do so, they are also permitted to be confident in their individual personalities and in their continuing growth. If we achieve the right feelings along these lines, we will say to ourselves, "There are latent forces within me, and I am capable of bringing them up out of my inner being. Therefore, wherever I see something I must honor because it is superior to me, not only must I honor it, but I may also trust myself to develop everything within me that will make me similar to it." The greater our ability to be attentive to certain processes in life that are not immediately familiar to our personal judgment, the greater the possibility of laying the foundations for leading our development into the spiritual worlds. An example may illustrate this. Individuals may find themselves in a situation in life where they can either do something or leave it undone. The judgment says do it, but there is still a certain inexplicable something in their feelings that keeps them from doing whatever it is. They can choose to pay no attention to this inexplicable something and simply do whatever their powers of judgment suggest. However, they can also give in to the urging of the inexplicable and refrain from going through with the action in question. If they then follow up the matter further, it may become evident that the results would have been disastrous if they had followed their judgment, and that it was a blessing that they refrained from that particular action. An experience like this can guide our thinking in a very specific direction, allowing us to recognize that there is something in us that guides us better than the degree of judgment we possess at present. We need to be open-minded about this something within us, which we are not mature enough to reach through our faculty of judgment. It is of the greatest possible benefit for the soul to pay attention to such instances in life, because they provide a healthy premonition that there is more in us than we can survey with our power of judgment at any given time. Such attentiveness works to expand our soul life. Once again, however, it is also possible for serious one-sidedness to result. If we got into the habit of always disregarding our judgment because of premonitions, impelling us to do this or that, we might become the playthings of all sorts of undefined urges. It is a short step from a habit of this sort to lack of judgment and superstition. For students of the Spirit, superstition of any sort is disastrous. It becomes possible for us to truly make our way into the domains of spiritual life only if we carefully guard ourselves against superstition, fantastic ideas, and daydreaming. We do not enter the spiritual world in the right way if we rejoice at every opportunity to experience something, quote, that cannot be grasped by the human mind, unquote. A preference for the inexplicable certainly does not make anyone a student of the Spirit. We must break ourselves of the biased habit of thinking that mystics are those who, quote, assume the existence of the inexplicable and the unfathomable, unquote, wherever they please. For students of the Spirit, the appropriate attitude is to acknowledge the presence of hidden forces and beings everywhere, but also to assume that the unfathomable can be successfully investigated if the necessary forces are available. A certain soul disposition is important to students of the Spirit at every level of development, and it consists not in expressing their desire for knowledge in a one-sided way, constantly asking how one question or another may be answered, but by asking how they can develop certain faculties. Once these faculties have developed through patient inner work, the answers to these questions appear by themselves. Students of the Spirit will always cultivate this soul disposition in themselves. This leads them to constantly work on themselves, to make themselves ever more mature, and to relinquish the desire to force answers to certain questions. They will wait until such answers come to them. Once again, if we become one-sided in this respect, we will not make much progress. At certain times, students of the Spirit can also have the feeling that they themselves are able to answer the most exalted questions with the forces currently at their disposal. Here, too, steadiness and balance in our soul disposition play an important role. It is helpful to cultivate and develop many more soul qualities if we are attempting to achieve inspiration through doing such exercises. Each of these qualities could be described individually, but in each case it would have to be emphasized that steadiness and balance are the all-important soul qualities. They prepare us to understand and to be able to carry out the exercises that have been described as necessary for achieving inspiration. The exercises for achieving intuition require students of the Spirit to extinguish from consciousness not only the images to which they devoted themselves in attaining imagination, but also the life of their own soul activity, which they contemplated in acquiring inspiration. Literally, nothing must remain in their souls from any previously known outer or inner experiences. However, if there were nothing in their consciousness after discarding these experiences, that is, if their consciousness disappeared and they sank into unconsciousness, they would realize that they had not yet matured enough to be able to undertake exercises to develop intuition, and they would have to continue the exercises for imagination and inspiration. Eventually, however, there comes a time when our consciousness is not empty when the soul casts off its inner and outer experiences, but something remains as an effect. It then becomes possible for us to give ourselves up to this effect, just as we previously gave ourselves up to something that owed its existence to outer or inner impressions. This residual effect is nevertheless very specific in character. In comparison to all our previous experiences, it is something really new. When we experience it, we know that this is something we are not familiar with before. We were not familiar with before. It is a perception, just as actual sound is a perception when our ears hear it. This new perception, however, is something that can only enter our consciousness through intuition, just as sound can only enter our consciousness through our ears. Intuition strips our impressions of their last sensory, physical remnants, and the spiritual world begins to be apparent to our cognition in a form that no longer has anything in common with the characteristics of the physical world of the senses. That is the end of paragraph 46 on page 349. I will be finishing chapter 5 in the next section that I read. This is the end of the third section of chapter 5 in the reading.